The views and opinions expressed on the following program are not necessarily those of the staff and management of Salem Media of Hawaii.
Welcome to Hawaii's Tomorrow. Coming up today, Jeff meets with newsmakers, shares breaking news, spotlights top community activities and leaders. He'll keep you ahead of the news and informed as you make your way home today. So join Jeff Davis right here, right now, and every day at 5. So stay tuned and you'll have something to talk about over dinner tonight with Hawaii's Tomorrow today. That's Hawaii's Tomorrow today.
Aloha! Welcome to Hawaii's Tomorrow. My name is Braden DeVos. I'm 7 years old, and I have a favor to ask you. Will you please protect the environment for me and the other children in the world? Thank you. Now take it, Solar Guy.
Aloha. I'm Carly Weiner, your Marine Science Gal on this Tuesday, December 3rd. And for our monthly December spot, we are going to be sending you our best holiday fishes as we speak with three amazing scientists about their important fish research. We will also hear about the Waimea Ocean Film Festival upcoming in January. We have a jam-packed show, so without further ado, I would like to introduce our first guest. With us today is David Utano, the Recreational Fisheries Specialist at NOAA Fisheries Pacific Islands Regional Office. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you. Thank you, Carly.
So, obviously you have a passion for fish. Tell us, what does a Recreational Fisheries Specialist do?
Sure. Actually, that's a great question because this is a new position for our region, completely new. That's one attractive point that attracted me to the position. It's a new program. And in fact, it's the only full-time recreational fisheries specialist in all of NOAA, in the whole U.S. It sort of signals a change in NOAA's direction that people consider, a lot of people think it's mostly to do with commercial fisheries. But my job is all about non-commercial fisheries, recreational. But that includes a wide variety of reasons people go fishing, not just for recreation, but for like subsistence and for cultural reasons. And what I do is basically I handle all issues to do with non-commercial fisheries, such as getting data from the fisheries. We don't have any, or very little. Catch and effort data, because they're not allowed, not required to report their catches, but they can be very significant for some species. And in some cases, more than the commercial catch. Well, I'll just say that my primary role, I would say, is to be a liaison between the fishing community, non-commercial fishing community, and NOAA, and try to foster kind of a two-way conversation so that I supply them with information about management of the fisheries, and they can come to me and provide their input. What's bothering them, what they think should be done, or improvements or suggestions, and I can take that to NOAA headquarters and for response.
So what do you see as being the most pressing fisheries issues for us here in Hawaii? Obviously, you focus on recreation. Mm-hmm. So what within that realm would you say is important?
Well, that kind of highlights one issue that we have in the Pacific Island region is that the term recreation for fishing doesn't really apply to the whole non-commercial fishing realm here because since we're in the region of the Western Pacific, my job entails representing American Samoa, Guam, the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands, and Hawaii. And in those other cultures and in Hawaii, fishing is a way of life, really. And it's conceptually different than the classical concept of recreational fishing, which is defined as fishing for sport or pleasure. There's a lot of people here that wouldn't consider that they are recreational fishermen, but they're not commercial fishermen. So a big challenge is representing that really diverse constituency across many different cultures and many reasons to go fishing. And kind of communicating that to headquarters, too, and to make sure that those people are represented.
Well, it sounds like a big job, and you're covering a huge area. What are some of the nuances or differences you see in Hawaii versus some of the other areas that you work, like you mentioned CNMI and Samoa?
Well, again, I used to work in Samoa. A lot of people know I was a chief fisheries biologist down there. And I worked in the South Pacific for quite a long time out of the South Pacific Commission before. And in those, a lot of the countries of the South Pacific, again, fishing is more of a cultural tradition, a way of life. And it's done for sustaining your family and also for sharing fish amongst people in a cultural sense. So, and a lot of that occurs in Hawaii, of course, too. But then we have well-developed sport fishing guides and charter boats and that sort of thing as well. So my job covers a pretty broad range of fishing types. So everything from very basic village-level fishing to high-class fly-in sport fishing charters.
Now, also working in Samoa, in addition to that, you've also done a lot of tuna and billfish work prior to your position at NOAA. What kind of research were you doing with those species?
That was primarily tuna fisheries in the large sense, large scale sense, purse seine and longline, poline line, by the countries of the South Pacific, but also what we call the distant water countries. Japan, Korea, Taiwan, U.S., etc. And those were commercial fisheries, large scale, and the largest resource that many of the countries in the South Pacific have. So extremely important financially and economically to these people, but also important in the sense that of the question of what are those fisheries doing or impacting to the small scale artisanal fisheries. So it's a very different world than I work in now, but I find the experience down there and the connections I have also assist in what I'm trying to do now. Yes.
So there's a lot of connections between all your experience, which has led you to where you are today. And you also sit on the Scientific and Statistical Committee for the Western Pacific Regional Fisheries Management Council. It's a big blurb. That's there. Fair. So what does that entail?
Well, I'll back up just slightly. There's another broader organization called the WCPFC, Western and Central Pacific Fishery Commission, and that's the international commission to which all the countries in the Central and Western Pacific are members, and this is the management body for fish and pelagic resources throughout the whole Western Pacific, and that's the world that I used to work in with the large-scale fisheries. Here you mentioned the Western Pacific Fishery Management Council, and that's a U.S. One of eight councils in the U.S., and these councils are set up to provide a place for different groups to discuss fishery issues and come up with management recommendations that the councils of each region put forth. But they're advised by a scientific committee, and that's the Scientific and Statistical Committee provides scientific advice on all those management decisions or thoughts. Gives it to the council, and the council deliberates and makes decisions on management recommendations. So
you get to be out in the field working with a lot of fishermen and also in the offices with management as well. So I guess you have best of both worlds. What's the most interesting thing about, I guess, the fish and the fishermen that you work with when you're out in the field?
Well, I love working with the fishermen. And, again, that's part of the major part of my job is extending that communication link so that they feel that they can talk to NOAA. And I love learning from them. Every fisherman I've ever worked with learned something, not only how to catch fish, but about their history in the fishery and how that can advise management. It's very important. So I think it's essential that we get out on the street and talk to people.
And that's a very good segue for what you do. these monthly recreational fisheries talk stories, right? And you have one coming up. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Every month now, on the second Wednesday of every month, I open up my offices to the public. And we have an office now, a NOAA office at Pier 38. And it's from 11 to 1. The next one will be on December 12th from 11 to 1. And we have a classroom kind of setting where people can come in and discuss any issue they want to. And I can provide them with updates on what's going on with NOAA, regulations coming down, issues, et cetera.
Well, that's great. David, thank you so much for taking some time to chat with us today. If people are interested in that talk story, they can find out more information at www.fpir.noaa.gov. I'd like to acknowledge our sponsors, Leakmaster Roofing, Grand Solar, BenQ Solar.
760 KGU.
Part of the Wall Street Business Network.
No problems except for a couple of accidents that we've had in the last half hour or so. In Pearl City, there was one on Ka'ahumanu at Kamehameha Highway. And we had another one on the freeway on the H1 Evabound at the Arizona Memorial exit over by the airport. No problems going over to the windward side on the Poly, the Likelike, or the H3. And we're looking typical going out east to Hawaii Kai.
Aloha, this is the solar guy, Jeff Davis. Do you want free 5 panels? How about a free trip to Vegas? I know, free financing. Then don't call me. For 25 years, Kamiyama Solar believes in treating our clients with respect. We do not subcontract. We do not offer anything for free, besides Aloha. What we do offer is hands-on installation with 25 years of experience and a 10-year workmanship warranty. Call me, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, at 554-7200. Aloha at 554-7200.
Aloha no hoi kako and ho mai kai no hoi praise to really Jeff listen. Davis.
You're terrible.
I'm terrible.
I love you, Ruby. Aloha. Aloha, this is your solar guy, Jeff Davis here. If you have any questions regarding HECO's new regulations for photovoltaics or solar electric in your neighborhood, as you know, they have new rules. Just call me at 554-7200. I'll answer your questions most likely right over the phone, 554-7200. And please don't forget, solar hot water, solar-powered pool pumps, solar heating, all that is good to go. I can handle any of those questions as well. Call your solar guy at 554-7200. Aloha. Hi, it's Jeff. Aloha. It seems as though Hawaiian Electric has made their decision to slow down photovoltaic solar electric installation throughout this last tax season. Many people have turned to battery storage systems to save money on the upgrades and to beat the tax season. These battery storage systems are standalone. You're not connected to the grid. You do receive this year's tax credits for them, and you can install them in any area on the island at any time. It's a fantastic idea. Now, I'm Kamiyama Solar, and we've installed many of these systems in the past. If you have any questions for me, they can be answered generically with a phone call. So go ahead and get to me, Jeff Davis, your solar guy, regarding battery storage systems for your photovoltaics this year at 554-7200. That's 554-7200. Aloha.
Hi, I'm Frank Rogers from Leakmaster Roofing and the Cool Roof Store. We sell and install protective roof coatings for all types of roofs. What kind of roof do you have? For flat roofs, we recommend silicone roof coatings because they withstand unlimited ponding water and they come with a 50-year material warranty. We feature trusted names like Geico, NXT Cool Zone, and Apoc Silicone with some of the lowest prices in town. If you have a Monier roof or a metal roof, we recommend that you recoat them with NXT Cool Zone to make them shine like new. Asphalt shingles can be protected and waterproof for the lifetime of your home with the Cool Roof Store's ceramic coating. Whether you want Leakmaster Roofing to install the coating or want to do it yourself, come on down to our store in Kaka'ako or visit us at leakmaster.com. Why re-roof when you can simply recoat?
My name is Braden DeVos, and I believe in education. I say get one. Take it, solar guy.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal. With us now is Alan Andrews. Dr. Andrews works as a research fisheries biologist with the Life History Program at NOAA Fisheries. He has spent over 20 years doing research in California and worked with numerous species all across the world. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Carly. It's great to be here.
I would personally like to introduce you as one of the most interesting men campaigns. Your research is so fascinating. I can't wait to share what you do. So let's start from the beginning before we even share with our listeners your methods. What do you think about fish age, and do you think about how old a fish is when you sit down to eat it?
Yeah, that's one of the things I kind of like to introduce when I talk with people about what I do, is to get them to think about how these fish grow, how long they can live, and why do we even care about how long these fish can live? And I find that in most cases, people really don't think about it. They equate the age of fish to maybe a goldfish that they had for 10 years, and they think pretty much every fish probably lives about 10 years old. Some understand it a little more than others, but that's sort of the segue into the work that I do, is asking people, basically, you know, how old do you think fish live?
Well, first off, if you had a goldfish that lasted 10 years, you have the magic touch. So how long do fish live, and why do we care how old fish are?
Well, I can get into that. Starting off with the goldfish, the longest lived goldfish is like 43 years. They've actually had a goldfish live that long. So there's a number of species that I've been working on lately. I've been working on the opaca-paca, and the original estimates for this fish were somewhere on the order of 5 or 18 years old for their maximum age, but they really didn't know how long it lived. And the work that I've been doing basically answered that question, and it turns out they can get to be over 40 years old.
Wow, that is an old living fish.
Yes.
And so how do you know that opaca-paca can be up to 40 years old?
Yeah, so that's the thing that I like to share. And one of the techniques that I use to answer that question is I use a method called bomb radiocarbon dating. And this has to do with finding the atmospheric signal that was created by nuclear testing in the atmosphere in the 50s and 60s. That signal, that radiocarbon signal, was sent throughout the world in the atmosphere, and then it worked its way into the ocean. That signal can be found in the fish ear bone if they were alive during that time. So if the fish was, like, say, the 43-year-old opaca-paca that I have, its birthday was somewhere in the mid-early 60s, and I could tie that date very specifically to that rise of radiocarbon from the testing of bombs during that time.
That is amazing. It's so incredible that you do that. And how do you extract this information from an ear, something as small as an ear bone?
Yeah, so the ear bones, and some people may not know what this is, it's called an otolith. That's the fish ear bone. They're kind of a special bone. They're more like a mineral. It's more, they don't get resorbed. So the otolith grows continuously through the life of the fish. And so the stuff that's in the middle, the core of the otolith, the deepest buried part, is birthday stuff. So I have to go in, and first of all, you can actually section these otoliths just like a tree. Like if you cut a tree, you can count growth zones in the tree. Same thing with the fish ear bone or the otolith. You can section the otolith, count the growth zones, and get an estimate of age. But with trees, we know the growth zones are one per year. But with fish, how do we know? So we have to validate that. So the bomb radiocarbon dating has to do with I take a little tiny dentist drill bit and I tap out the very center of the otolith. And then we measure that very, very small quantity of material for radiocarbon. So basically that center, the core of the otolith, represents the marine chemistry at the time it was born. And then we link that to records that are found in coral cores. So the coral grows, you know, they grow bands every year. And there are solid records that go back in time that can tell us what the marine chemistry was like at that time. And so the measurement that we make from the otolith core can be correlated to the coral record. And that gives us a very specific age.
That is very precise work. You must have very good precision. And how many species have you done this method for? Does it work on everyone, or certain species are better than others?
Yeah, certain species are better than others. The more shallow living species in the mixed layer, the upper part of the ocean, deep water tends to have the bomb radiocarbon signals tends to be in the upper parts of the ocean. So so these fish, like, you know, the snappers and the groupers, they work quite well. I've done quite a bit of work with the rockfishes along the West Coast. deep sea fishes like orange roughy, we have to do other techniques in order to come up with validated ages for them. But it's working quite well here. We're finishing up the kala, which is the blue-spined unicorn fish, the hapu'upu'u, which is the Hawaiian grouper. Those I'll probably be published in a paper this next year. The Opakapaka paper is already published. Working on the Onaga right now. We're getting age estimates on the order of 50 years old for them, but I need to validate it, so that's a work in progress.
Wow. And what implications does this have for how we fish and manage our fisheries? I mean, this has got to change the way we look at fish age and what we do with
right.
the fish.
Right. The important part of this is what... When you consider how long the fish lives, if they live to be 30 or 40 or 50 years old, then that means each fish has a much greater potential to contribute back to the population. And so it's fairly complicated. I don't do the stock assessment side of things, which basically these numbers are put into a big system where they do an assessment of the health of the population, and then they make management decisions based on those numbers. So the changes in longevity will change how they rate the fishery and how many fish we can take for sustainability. By the way, that's sort of the target is sustainability of the fishery.
So this is very important information for managers to have, so they can better assess, you know, what to do with the fish. Is this only happening for Hawaii, or is this type of research happening in other locations?
It is happening in other locations. I'm expanding my work to the Great Barrier Reef. I'm doing work on a couple of species there. And throughout the Indo-Pacific, I've got some other projects started. But I have colleagues in Seattle with the Alaska Fisheries Science Center. Craig Castell does this kind of work with the rockfishes and some of the other species of that region. In Europe, there's some other people doing work. I'm actually working with an Italian colleague right now on the European hake. So we're kind of spreading around and seeing if we can get, you know, answer some of these important questions.
That's amazing. And is there any favorite location or interesting species that you've worked with that, you know, has kind of stuck with you?
I guess I like the charismatic reef species, like the bumphead parrotfish and the humphead wrasse. I mean, they're just
nice
amazing animals, huge. They used to get really huge. They're not so many of the real big ones around anymore. They're an amazing animal.
And how old do they get?
It wasn't the largest, and it was 45 years old. And that was the bumphead parrotfish from the Great Barrier Reef.
Wow, that's amazing. Next time I go snorkeling, I'm going to think all the fish are older than I am. And so with this work continuing on a global scale, do you have plans to move on to new species for Hawaii, or what's next for your research in particular?
Yeah, in particular, I suppose, well, like I said, the European hake is a little bit of an offshoot. But continuing through the bottom fishes for Hawaii, we have, you know, Gendai is on the list. I'm finishing up the hapu'upu'u, which is the Hawaiian grouper. But we're also expanding to the Western Pacific. We want to do this kind of work in Guam and in the CNMI region. There's no bomb radiocarbon record there yet, but I'm pursuing... documenting the bomb radiocarbon signal with a coral core that I sampled from some Japanese researchers. I went to Okinawa a couple of months ago, and we sampled the coral core for radiocarbon. So we're trying to get that work done so that we can apply that technique there as well.
And do you have any concerns or hopes for the future of fisheries that maybe this work can contribute to?
I can only hope that it makes things on the sustainable side as opposed to over-exploitation.
And can this work be applied to other species besides fish? I know you mentioned you're using coral cores as well.
Yeah, it can be applied to anything that has a conserved skeletal structure. I finished some work on the white abalone in California. It's an endangered species. It's the first... marine invertebrate to actually be listed as an endangered species. And so we use the shell to track the bomb radiocarbon signal from places off of Southern California.
And I have to ask, how long do they live?
They get to be on the order of 30 years old.
Wow, that's amazing. And is there any last messages about your research you would like to share for today?
No, just think about what you eat before you eat it.
Well, I can't wait to see some of your papers and some of this age dating. I think it's really important. Thank you for your time. It's been fascinating. We'll take a quick traffic break, and when we come back, we will be talking with Dr. Ivor Williams.
I- 760 KGU,
part of the Wall Street Business Network.
Got one new accident. This one's out on the H1 freeway, everbound at the Waimalu Pearl City exit. If you're going that way from town, the Moanalua slows at Kaiser Hospital. H1 slows at the west end of the airport viaduct. Windward Drive, normal, no problems to Hawaii Kai. A reminder, there are lane closures in both directions of Dillingham near Koho Street in Kalihi because of that water main break.
Aloha. This is a solar daughter, Lena Davis. My dad, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, has been telling me to listen to him my whole life. It's helped me, and I'm sure it'll help you too. Be sure to listen to My Dad, the Solar Guy, 5 to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday on 760 KGU. Aloha.
Aloha, it's Jeff. Is it hotter in your home than out on your lanai? Do you wish there was an energy-efficient way to cool down? Wouldn't it be nice to turn on the trays at the flip of a switch? Well, my friends at Island Cooling have been quietly promoting the energy-efficient whole house fan for years. It works by drawing fresh air through your home, pushing the hot air out through your attic. Call the whole house fan experts at Island Cooling, 672-2300, 672-2300, or go to islandcooling.com. Aloha.
Aloha, it's your solar guy, Jeff Davis. You know, I'm offering you folks a chance to get an education, this time about on-bill financing. You've heard about the new bill the governor signed, paying for your photovoltaic system on your electricity bill. As you may know, the governor just signed this revolutionary bill, and it is directed and aimed at folks that have no ability to find the upfront money for their photovoltaic purchase. If you have questions, you can always call me or attend my seminar. Get a hold of me at 554-7200. That's 554-7200. And aloha.
So you're doing the right thing. You're getting a solar voltaic system for your home or business. But did you know the crucial decision is which microinverter to choose? A microinverter is what's going to convert the sunshine from your solar panels into electricity you can use.
But not all microinverters are created equal.
The Enexis microinverter system dramatically boosts energy harvest with higher wattage microinverters. We're talking up to 40% over its competitors. Year after year, you'll be getting more bang for your buck.
Because not all microinverters are created equal.
So make sure your contractor offers the Enexis microinverter with the system you can monitor yourself. Your system will shine today and be ready for a brilliant tomorrow. For more information, visit enexis.com. That's enexis.com. E-N-E-C-S-Y-S.com. That's E-N-E-C-S-Y-S.com.
If you would like to join Jeff Davis and his guests on the air, call now at 296-5467. That's 296-5467. Now back to the Solar Guy.
You're listening to Hawaii's Tomorrow with Jeff Davis, the Solar Guy.
Welcome back. Today we have been talking about some impressive research coming out of NOAA Fisheries. Up next is Dr. Ivor Williams, who is the lead research fish biologist for the Pacific Islands Fisheries Science Center, or PIFSES, if you want to be a NOAA aficionado with all the acronyms. He works under the CRED program, which is the Coral Reef Ecosystem Division. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks very much.
So you, too, have an extremely important, fascinating job where you spend a lot of time in the water assessing fish populations. How exactly do you do this?
The team I work for, the fish team, almost all our work is done with divers in the water. And so what we do is we work across 40 islands spread across the Pacific, Hawaii, Guam, Marianas, American Samoa, and sort of remote island areas. And essentially what we do is we do exactly the same thing everywhere. And we randomly pick a spot. We don't try to pick a good spot. We don't try to find a bad spot. We just go anywhere essentially off a map. We have a randomization method, and we drop a team of divers in. And they have a standard way that they go down, they count fish, they estimate the size. And that gives us a way to get exactly consistent data from across this huge area. And that, in turn, allows us to make judgments about the relative status of different parts of the Pacific.
So that's kind of exciting. You never know if you're going to come onto a coral rubble bed with nothing on it or a thriving coral reef.
Yeah, that's true. And in the Pacific, you get a lot of places, so there's a lot of big waves. And so that has a huge impact. And so we can get to, you can get to places that are in incredibly healthy condition, but at times they're not, you know, they're really hammered hard by the waves and the habitat's not super great. But even in places like that, you know, you can still see wonderful stuff in places.
And I imagine it might change from different times of year. Have you gone back to a particular spot at different points in the year when it's looked differently?
You know, I don't think that is so true of coral reef fish. I mean, it affects your ability to get in the water. But, you know, these are very long-lived species on the whole. They tend not to move a very large amount on a regular basis. So a lot of times, if you can get in the water, you're going to see kind of similar stuff from a coral reef at least.
And your team works very hard to be accurate and highly efficient. How do you train your team to do that?
Yeah, so I mean, everything we do, it's a real challenge for us to get enough data because we're dealing with huge areas. And we've got seven people who work for our group. And we're spread across, you know, even in Hawaii, there's a billion square meters of coral reef. And so, you know, we need to get as good data as we possibly can. And then essentially that means trying to get people consistent. And so we do a lot of training. A really important thing we do is trying to get people good at estimating size, because fish size is a really important measure of, you know, the health of the community, the status of breeding stocks. And and if you get that right, you know, your data is an awful lot better. So that's a big thing we do. And we work a lot with different models up to a meter and a half, 2 meters long. And we sort of lay them out and people go out and estimate the size, compare it against reality. It's kind of a shock for people when they first do it. Mm-hmm. But people have been doing it a while, and that's most people we work with are pretty good now.
It must be nice to see people improve with that technique as well. And
yeah, sure. I mean, we pretty much hope everybody we've got working most of the time get past that stage. And, you know, people are good at what they do on the whole.
I bet. And you mentioned you work elsewhere outside of Hawaii, not just here with the state. How do you determine what areas you work in?
Yeah, so, I mean, we don't have a lot of choice. We're representing the federal government. And so we are working all U.S.-affiliated and U.S. coral reef areas in the Pacific. So that is, you know, there's a huge spread, and there's some great places there. But we don't have a huge amount of choice of where we wanted to go if we want to go somewhere else.
So do you personally have a favorite spot that you've been at?
You know, one of the things we do is we have a privilege of being able to go to places that are 1,000, 2,000 kilometers away from the nearest human. And those places are almost always spectacular. And you know, my favorite, I guess, is probably Palmyra Atoll. And that's because I spend a little bit more time there. But anywhere you drop in the water, you see a huge amount of just a great mass of fish, lots of big fish, really exciting stuff all the time, humphead wrasse, big sharks, very commonly, 10, 15 sharks on a dive would be really normal, sometimes more. So, you know, it's really, almost all these remote places are wonderful, but I guess that's my favorite.
Well, definitely a perk of the job, that is for sure.
Yeah.
And so from Palmyra Atoll to Maui, let's say, you do a broad amount of work, and you work a lot with the state as well. You have some success stories with management improving fish communities. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the Kahakili management area?
Yeah. So as well as the large-scale work, we also try to do a few little projects with the local agencies where we can. And we really want to try to expand that and try to be useful. And so one of the projects we've been working on is the Kahakili Herbivore Fishery Management Area in Kaanapali, West Maui. And that was created by the state of Hawaii in 2009. And we had data from about 15 years previously that showed coral cover was declining. There'd been regular macroalgal blooms. And it's still in quite good condition, the reef, but it's undoubtedly on the way down. And one of the reasons, there's a bunch of things going on there, but one of the reasons is that herbivore fish were probably very depleted there. It's a popular fishing spot, it's a lot of access. And, you know, so compared to other areas, compared to marine protected areas, fish populations are pretty low. So what the state of Hawaii did is establish an area about 2 miles of coastline where you're not allowed to take herbivorous fish, you can't take sea urchins, all other forms of fishing are permitted. And so it's much more acceptable to a lot of the general community. It's not trying to close off an area, it's just trying to enhance the habitat quality. And it's very innovative. A lot of places in the world are interested in that kind of approach. But Hawaii is kind of leading the world in that. And anyway, that's 4 years in. And we've been monitoring it, you know, with the state of Hawaii very carefully. And things are going pretty well. Fish stocks are up considerably. Benthic community is in good condition relative to where it was. But we're talking 10, 15, 20 years before we really know for sure whether that place is going to make a huge difference.
Well, the data so far looks really good. A coworker of yours, Dr. Zamzow, I saw a talk she gave a couple weeks ago, and she talked a little bit about that. I mean, you guys are starting to see some preliminary results already.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so, as we were hearing earlier, I mean, these fish live a long time. And so we're 4 years post-closure, and, you know, some of the surgeon fish are going to live over 50 years. Parrotfish a little rather less, but still, you know, many years. And so, you know, 4 years is not even anywhere near a generation time for a fish. So these things will take, you know, a while to recover. But already you've seen a doubling of parrotfish biomass, some increase in surgeon fish, about 50% increase. And what's really encouraging is there's a lot more big parrotfish, and they're probably ecologically very important. They have, you know, these parrot-like beaks, and they gouge the substrate, and they have a kind of very strong retarding effect on algal growth. And so more of them is really what's probably going to enable that reef to sort of thrive. So things are going very well so far. But as I say, I mean, corals are slow growing. It's going to take a long time before we really know for sure what effect that has on the coral communities, which is the ultimate goal.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens with that. And this is a clear example of how your data can apply to management. What else do you do with your data once it's collected?
Well, we have a certain amount of sort of just normal reporting requirements, but most of our data is fed into either management or to the scientific community. And it's used in management for assessing the status of populations. It's starting to get used for stock assessments. And the thing that makes our data particularly useful in that regard is that, you know, we work off a 200-foot survey vessel that goes out on three-month cruises. So we can go anywhere, more or less. And we can go to Niihau, North Molokai. We can get, you know, out to extremely remote spots. And so, you know, there's state programs, there's a lot of programs where people have very, very good data from small areas, and they can do that brilliantly. They know those areas far better than we ever will. But they can't get, there's a lot of places they can't get to. And some of those places are pretty good because there's not a lot of people there. They're kind of hard to access. And if you want to get an overall idea of how things are doing, it's important you get there. Even if you go even further away, when it's literally 500, 1,000 kilometers away from people, those are where you start to get to these spectacular, incredible places, which are just really, really different than anywhere where people are. So our program kind of provides that perspective, which is extremely difficult to get unless you can really cover that kind of range of places.
And covering such a huge range, is there one particular project that you think is very interesting that you'd like to share with us?
So, I mean, we already talked about Kakili, and that is a favorite project of mine. But I guess one other thing I think is interesting to me and hopefully to others is that one of our limitations is everything working with divers, so they can only go so deep. You also put a diver in the water, there's some potential there that you affect fish populations and fish behavior, and it might affect your counts. So we're starting to work a lot with remote stereo video. They're kind of low-tech, it's just off-the-shelf video systems, but nowadays those systems are good enough that you can get really good imagery. And we can drop those down way past the depths divers can go. So now we can start to get a really good idea of what's going on in waters that are deeper that can be really important for some of these species. And we can also do it without a diver in the water. So we see all kinds of stuff we really don't see in shallow water. And it's really cool and interesting. And once we've seen how we turn that into data across the scale we're working at. But so far, so good.
And your team does a variety of this type of research collection, I mean, from the videos to tow boards. For those of our listeners that don't know what a tow board is, this is kind of a cool method. Can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, so it's called a manta tow in some places, and it involves a pair of divers that are about 50 foot high in a boat, and they're holding a sort of a board, a large board, which they can steer with. And then they're being dragged in a continual direction where the driver is trying to keep them above a certain depth of reef. And that just enables them to cover long distances. And then the problem is if you're in the water as a diver, it's hard for you to cover a lot of ground. And if you want to see rare stuff, you want to see stuff that's a little bit spooked by divers, you want to be mobile. And so if you can cover about 2 kilometers in an hour survey, you can do 6 of those a day, we've got 12 kilometers, you know, the team has covered thousands of kilometers of reef, you know, so far. And that's usually our best data on some of this rare big stuff, sharks, jacks, humphead rasp, humphead parrotfish, things like that.
You guys are a well-oiled machine.
Try to be.
So any plans for 2014 that you can share with us?
Next year, we're on a rotation every year where we go, and next year it's the Mariana Archipelago and Wake. And Wake is the one place in the U.S. Pacific where you're going to see a lot of bumphead parrotfish. Mariana's a, you know, great place too.
Well, I wish you guys the best of luck. It sounds like you're doing some great stuff, and we look forward to hearing some of the results. like to acknowledge some of our sponsors today, the University of Hawaii Research Corporation, State of Hawaii Natural Energy Lab, D.R. Horton Schuler Homes, University of Hawaii Federal Credit Union, R&R Solar Supply, and Hank's Tax Service.
760 KGU.
Part of the Wall Street Business Network.
On Dillingham Boulevard in Kalihi, expect slowdowns because of lane closures near Coho Street. Had a water main break last night, and they're still working on it. Had an accident earlier this afternoon in Kaimuki on Waialae. A utility pole was damaged, and crews are working on that right now. That's going to take this evening. There are lane closures in both directions near Wilhelmina Rise.
Aloha. If you would like to work with Jeff and Kamiana Solar in a sales position, Jeff is hiring qualified people for full or part-time positions. Please call Jeff at 554-7200. That's 554-7200.
If you would like to contact Jeff either about the program or have any other questions about solar photovoltaics or hot water, call 554-7200. That's 554-7200.
Aloha, this is the solar guy, Jeff Davis. Do you want free 5 panels? How about a free trip to Vegas? I know, free financing. Then don't call me. For 25 years, Kamiyama Solar believes in treating our clients with respect. We do not subcontract. We do not offer anything for free, besides Aloha. What we do offer is hands-on installation with 25 years of experience and a 10-year workmanship warranty. Call me, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, at 554-7200. Aloha at 554-7200.
Over the past century, more than 90% of koa forests in Hawaii have disappeared as tropical hardwood prices have skyrocketed. Hawaii's koa forests are an important part of our ecosystem and a symbol of our island heritage. Hawaiian Legacy Hardwoods and Hawaii's Tomorrow need your help to repopulate 1,000 acres on the Big Island with new koa trees. For $60, you can sponsor your very own koa legacy tree on the slopes of Mauna Kea. Legacy trees can honor an individual, commemorate an event, or memorialize a loved one. Along with a beautifully engraved personalized certificate, $20 will also be donated to the charity or organization of your choice. Gift a gift that grows grander year after year. And see how simple the act of planting a tree can change the face of the planet. To plant your Hawaiian Koa Legacy Tree, go to hawaiistomorrow.com and click on the Legacy Tree icon. Again, hawaiistomorrow.com. That's Hawaii's with an S, tomorrow.com.
280,000 acres. That's the size of Molokai, Lanai, and Kahoolawe put together. It's also the amount of the prime farmable ag land designated in Hawaii. 280,000 acres. That's a lot of prime farmable ag land, and it needs to be preserved for agriculture. Aloha, I'm Dean Okimoto of Nalo Farms, and this fact is brought to you by Ho'opili, a new community where commercial farms, neighborhood, and home gardens will be part of the community's design. And there's so much more. Log on to www.ho'opilioahu.com.
My name is Braden Navas, and I believe in education. I say get one. Take it, Solar Guy.
Welcome back. Today we've been talking about some of the impressive research coming out of NOAA Fisheries. For the last bit of our program, I wanted to chat with the amazing Tanya Howard about the upcoming Waimea Ocean Film Festival. Tanya is calling in from Waimea. Are you there?
I am here, Carly. Hi.
Hi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, Tanya, this is the fourth year you are running the festival. Can you tell us a little bit about the event?
Sure. It's a very exciting event. Films play simultaneously across multiple venues in Waimea from January 2nd to January 5th before moving to Four Seasons Resort Hualalai, January 6th through 10th. Many of the filmmakers are here to talk about their films. There are also breakfast talks, morning activities such as sunrise yoga on the beach or outrigger canoe lessons. Also a number of exciting receptions as well.
It's amazing, and it sounds like such a great event. How did this all start?
You know, it started a bit by accident. I saw a film when I was on the mainland that seemed so important, I thought it should be shown here. So I talked to one of the local theaters. They happened to have space available in a few weeks. I found 5 other films, so 6 films in total, that kind of collectively told a story about what's happening in the oceans today. And I only meant to show that series one time, but people started to ask if I would take it to Hilo and then to Kona and then Maui and Oahu and then on tour around the mainland. So I showed the series eight times before deciding to refocus on one larger event here on the Big Island and inviting speakers and filmmakers in, turning it into something something bigger, having talks to kind of point positive towards solutions as well. So that was the beginning.
And so the ocean is a pretty big topic and encompasses so much. What types of films do you screen? What is it so important about the content?
Well, the general categories are ocean experience, so that could be surfing, paddling, sailing, being out on the water. Ocean environment, and that looks directly at the ocean as well as things that we do on land that impact the sea. Island culture is another wonderful, very rich category, looking both at Hawaiian culture as well as other island cultures, people that live directly with the ocean, and inspirational films as well on various topics.
And the festival attracts filmmakers from all over, or what kind of filmmakers come out for this?
Yes, we do have filmmakers here from all over the world. Last year, from London, New Zealand, Australia. So that's quite exciting. A number of Norwegian films again this year as well.
Oh, wow. They're coming from everywhere then.
Yeah.
And it's not just for adults, right? The film festival, you try really hard to include some students.
Yes. In fact, most of the films, I would say, are family-friendly films. We do work on having school showings for students following the festival at local schools here around Waimea. We have very discounted rates for our student passes. We've been working on developing a student lending library that hopefully will be available, is right now on an informal basis for teachers to reach out and request copies of films to show in their classes. And then, as you know, this year we're working with COSI to host a student film showing block. COSI's actually been orchestrating a student film contest, and I think you told me that you might have chosen some of the winners.
Yeah, we were actually screening some of them today, and I have to say I am so impressed and humbled by some of the films that the students have made. And I feel somewhat like I was not a talented child after seeing some of these films. It is unbelievable. We have over 40 films to view at this point, so we're still getting through them, but I think we are going to have some fantastic final products. They're all really good.
Oh, that's exciting.
Mm-hmm, it is. And what I love about what you've done with the film festival too, Tanya, is it's not just film festival. It's all encompassing. You know, you said you had activities and you're doing lending libraries for schools. You also do a lot of, you know, science talks or talks related to the films. And I think it's really important that you do this work and bring the community in. Have you gotten a lot of positive response from the community about the film festival?
Yes, we have. You know, a lot of people have told me that it's really been a life-changing experience for them. And once people go to see one film, they get kind of swept up in the whole event, which is the idea, and then start planning on it for the next year. So that's been exciting to see.
And can you let us in on an exclusive sneak peek? I know we're working together a little bit, so maybe you can share something that not everybody knows.
Sure. Yes, there are over 50 films screening this year, and they're all quite exceptional. I suppose marine-related, we have The Last Ocean, which will have its Hawaiian premiere here, about the Ross Sea, which is a really beautiful film. Silver of the Sea, which is a Norwegian film looking at the Atlantic herring runs, also beautifully done. Ocean Frontier is kind of a neat, sort of point-positive film looking at successful collaborations between fishermen, scientists, even farmers and shipping companies all working collaboratively to protect marine environments and fishing resources. So that's kind of an exciting film.
Wow, it sounds like you have a really good lineup there. Has there been one or two films that have kind of stood out for you in the past from previous years that, you kind of keep that message with you and inspire you for the following year?
Yes, you know, there really are some films that do that. In fact, we're bringing back three films from last year by popular request. and one of them finding Joe about the work of Joseph Campbell and the hero's journey. Alan Cohen is coming along with that as well, one of the presenters in the film, and he's going to actually do a workshop here. We're also bringing back Chasing Ice and North of the Sun, which is another beautifully done Norwegian film.
Excellent. And is there any reason? It seems like there's a lot of Norwegian films. Is there just a lot of ocean focus coming out of the filmmakers from that area? Or is there a special connection between Hawaii and the Nordic area?
You know, I think I just happened to tell you about the two Norwegian films we've ever screened.
And the Finding Joe film, you said there's going to be a workshop. What kind of workshop do you guys offer along with the films?
Well, in this case, Alan Cohen is a very well-known speaker, author, presenter. He does his own workshops that people travel from all over the world to attend. And as he has enjoyed the festival so much, he offered to kind of do this as part of the event. So focusing on people's, their own hero's journey within. So I think that'll be quite neat.
So I imagine something like that would fill up really quickly. How do people sign up for the affiliated activities or know what films are going to be showcased when?
Well, the full festival program will be posted on our website, WaimeaOceanFilm.org, probably right around December 21st. It's going to be a bit of a mad sprint up until that point to get it done. And until then, people can watch our Facebook page. We're starting to unveil the program there. To sign up for any of the events, generally that's done during the festival itself at our hospitality desk, which is set up at Kahilu Theater in Waimea, and we'll also have a desk at the Fairmont Orchid this year. Or they can call the festival office, which is, should I get that number?
Sure, go ahead.
It's 808-854-6095.
And so to encourage people to come out to the film festival, especially from those folks that are on different islands or over in Hilo, what would you say for you is the big highlight of the film festival?
You know, I think having so much going on at the same time, it's very dynamic. So with the programming, I really work to have films and different topics, something that would really appeal for everyone going on at all times. And it's really fun and exciting to look through the program and try to figure out what you want to go see. You know, also having the filmmakers and speakers here is so accessible to dialogue with and talk to is a really exciting part of the event.
It's also really nice that the subject matter you're talking about, you're surrounded by. I mean, I don't know too many other ocean film festivals that take place right on the ocean.
Right, or in such a beautiful spot on the ocean.
And is there any other information or last tidbits you want to give our listeners about the Waimea Ocean Film Festival?
Well, we really love having people follow and like us on Facebook. So if anybody is interested in getting engaged and more involved, we'd love to see you on our page there.
Excellent. Well, Tanya, thank you so much for taking some time to chat with us. We're really excited about the event, and I'm very, very excited about the student film competition and having our winners showcased at your event.
Yes, I'll look forward to seeing what you chose.
I look forward to seeing some of the films, so thank you so much.
Great. Thanks, Carly.
Thank you. For more information on our show today, not only on the Waimea Ocean Film Festival, but on amazing research that's happening at NOAA Fisheries, please go to our website, www.cosi-ie.net. I'd like to give a special thanks to Jeff Davis, Kosi Island Earth, and the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. I'd also like to acknowledge some of the Solar Guy sponsors, Island Cooling and Whole House Fan, Kanale Ukulele, and Nexus Micro Inverters, and BenQ Solar. I'm Carly Weiner. Thanks for listening. Now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.